gentlemen, you are listening to Drive Through HR, and this is your host, Nisha, and my partner in crime, William Tincub, may well join anytime soon, but we have a fantastic guest joined with us today, Joseph Murphy. Welcome back to Drive Through HR.
Thank you, Nisha. It is great to be back. Appreciate an opportunity to join in the conversation at Drive Through HR.
Well, Joseph, it's been a long time that you have been here. So what's going on in your world? We can't wait to hear all about the insights that you're about to share with our wonderful audience. But before we get to that, we would really appreciate if you can talk a little bit about you, who you are, and what you do.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate the invitation. I'm the vice president of Shaker. We're one of the market leaders in developing simulations as a form of gamifying the job application. We recreate the job as a game, as an interactive experience. So the candidates test drive the job, learn a lot about the job, as you learn a lot about them by seeing how they perform your work. And
that
allows companies
cool.
to kind of, well, thank you. Yeah, the candidates love it. Recruiters become more effective, and it documents the economic impact from our approach to big data talent analytics.
Mm-hmm. So, Joseph, let me get right to it. What's keeping you up at night these days?
Well, one of the things that's been sitting with me lately is this notion of time to fill. I was at a recruiting conference recently, and it was on metrics, and they were facilitating some focus groups, and they talked about lots of different metrics, and then the facilitators wanted the recruiters to kind of identify what they thought was the most important metric, and the group universally said time to fill. And I was kind of surprised by that because of the range of other metrics that they spoke about that morning, and it made me think about two things. What do they believe the organization wants them to do, and how can they present the value that they bring to the organization? So I got thinking about time to fill and its impact, and I think actually it's time to kill time to fill. I don't think it's a metric that adds a lot of value to the recruiting process.
That's pretty interesting, because when we talk about recruiting, that's one of the foremost metrics normally comes to our mind, right, the time to fill. But when you see the other way, the time to kill is where the recruiters are using more and more time, but when it comes to getting that candidates attracted to the position or to fill that position, there are a lot of things that recruiters should and must do to actually kill that time, right, to shorten that time. So what do you recommend to our recruiters when it comes to killing that time, make it a little more shorter, make it more effective, and fill that position as soon as possible?
Well, I don't know if that's the objective. That's why I'm saying it's time to kill, the metric time to kill or time to fill, and that it distracts us from a more important thing. Getting somebody to show up to start the job may not be the most effective metric. And so when our progress is measured by a start date and a stop date, it's very easy to manipulate that by hiring the first person who applies.
And all right.
So does it force us into a measurement activity that's outside of the impact of the organization? And so I put a couple of ways to think about this. If we look at what we really want to obtain in the hiring process, it is a proficient performer, somebody who can execute to the demands of the job to standards or above of what the performance expectations are. And time to fill can be very independent of or potentially contrary to achieving that. And if we use a manufacturing analogy of raw goods versus finished goods, I can get raw goods to the manufacturing and say time to delivery, but what I sell is my finished goods. And when we use that analogy with talent, we say every job has some degree of learning curve. So we hire somebody quickly, but how long does it take them to achieve proficiency or mastery in the job. And I think a better way to measure the organization's performance of recruiting outcomes is measuring time to proficiency. How long does it take to source someone, screen, onboard, train, and get them to that point where they're performing effectively in their job? And so I believe a much more meaningful metric is time to proficiency, not time to fill. And it happens, we can look at it from a couple of different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
Time to fill is a very task-based process that's more silo-oriented, and that it looks at a small segment of the talent acquisition process, where time to proficiency is a much more systems thinking and strategic alignment to say the hiring decision must drive productivity, performance, execution, delivery of the business strategy, and just marking time from a start date to a stop date lacks any of that specific insight. One of the things that we can fall prey to is easy versus effective. And if we're just tracking days on a calendar from when we got the go to hire somebody to when we got somebody to actually show up, that's a really easy metric. And there are much better metrics that require more work and require more systems that actually document the impact of staffing outcomes.
Well, you know, Joseph, when we talk about, you know, easy versus effectiveness and then time to fill versus time to proficiency, there is a debate that is going on among recruiters versus HR. Well, when we talk about recruiters, they are more focusing on the numbers and their targets. But when we talk to HR, they would focus more on the culture fit. So to your perspective, what is more important, culture fit versus competence, if you get a chance? Which one do you value most?
Well, they're inseparable. To perform within the context of an organization implies that I will have to be culturally appropriate. And so if I'm measuring time to proficiency, and proficiency has a element of collaboration, inclusiveness, and, you know, productivity within the context of the organization, I can't achieve that in a robust manner. It would be lopsided if it was a poor culture fit. So I think that they're inclusive of each other, and you can't achieve actual mastery or proficiency outside of the culture fit of the organization. That would be disruptive, I think. And so you have to have a screening and a onboarding process where I identify people who can adapt and thrive within this culture, contribute to it, as well as achieve their productivity objectives.
So how does this time to proficiency would help our recruiters and then eventually HR and hiring managers to improve the quality of hire?
That's a great question. You know, so what really goes into that? See, time to fill carries with it no qualitative measures of the hiring decision or how the person actually turns out working on the job. And so time to proficiency is a long-term measure where not only do I have to get them through the door, but I have to capture data about their performance over a period of time. Now, in our work, we have some jobs where they rate time to proficiency in 90 to 120-day units. Some of our jobs are measured in two-year units, where it takes 2 years for somebody to really become proficient. And so when you're entering into analytic models where you're collecting periodic data over the course of 2 years or over the course of 90 to 120 days, you can actually map out and graph productivity differences within a hired population to look at, did I identify something in the candidate evaluation that has a relationship with different proficiencies in the learning curve? And so we've measured it from a couple of different ways. And so one of our clients has a body of knowledge that new hires have to go through to effectively sell their products and services. And so they have this self-study curriculum. And we were studying that over a period of a year and identified traits and characteristics that were evaluated in the candidate experience that had a relationship with faster completion of that self-study curriculum. Now, the outcome of learning that body of knowledge is more effective service, more sales opportunity, cross-sell, upsell, refer products and services to an organization, which I can't do unless I have the product knowledge. So it not only looked at time to acquire the knowledge, but then you can look at, was the knowledge used and did it actually relate to changes or differences in the service delivery within that role? Another example, in a contact center environment, one of the measures of effectiveness in some contact centers is this measurement of after-call work. And so you can actually, it's because the measured nature of performance in a contact center, you can actually say after training, if we look at performance variation of how long it takes people in general to complete their after-call work, do we see things that we've learned about an individual at the time of hire that has a relationship to different handle time factors in the analytics? And so by having a metrics-driven candidate evaluation, you can do analysis and say, what did I measure at the in the candidate experience that I can do analysis with in the new hire job performance, so that your quality of hire is improved by seeing how it plays out over time in that time to proficiency, and so you can actually fine-tune your candidate evaluation to drive more of people who take a more rapid approach to achieving proficiency.
So let me ask you, what are some three common metrics that recruiters should know when it comes to doing a metric-driven candidate evaluation process?
Well, every company interviews. And so if you're using a behaviorally anchored rating scale and you rate each candidate on the competencies that you interview, now you've got a numeric value for whatever it is that might be important for the job, you know, decision-making, collaboration, customer sensitivity, whatever competencies might be in the job at the time of the interview, if you create a numeric rating for how effective that candidate is based on the interview, that's your first level of data that becomes available. The second level of data would be if you're using a scorable application in your applicant tracking system, that you can actually put weight on certain work experiences, work history, responses to any questions you might be using in your applicant tracking system. And again, you can analyze that over time and say, does the response to these questions have a relationship to job performance downstream? And then the third level would be using some type of a standardized pre-employment assessment. And, you know, that's what we do. That's why I have a lot of knowledge on this is, our clients use a very robust multi-method assessment that allows them to collect, you know, in the neighborhood of 200 to 300 data points about an individual that they'll never find on a resume, about their work style, their work experiences, their decision making, their situational, how they handle situations, how they show up and do the work. And then we can study that over time and say, can we refine this? Can it get better? Can it push the needle of identifying people who achieve proficiency more effectively and more rapidly? So, you know, those are the three levels of measuring. But, you know, I did a survey with the Society of Human Resource Management a number of years ago and only found that about 35% of companies were using a behaviorally anchored rating scale, and an even smaller percentage actually enters those ratings into a database so they can actually study it and do something with it. So there's that robust discipline that recruiters have an opportunity to take advantage of, but there's a discipline of getting those numbers into a place that they can be analyzed.
So there is more to do with technology when it comes to talent assessment as well, right? So what are some trends that you are seeing in the talent assessment field? And going forward in 2015, how would that how do you expect that to be evolved?
That's a great question as well. And there's a number of people doing surveys out there. I've been a participant in the Candidate Experience Award survey since its inception, and we see a higher adoption of pre-employment assessments across the population that has participated in that. There's a couple of other organizations that have been, periodically surveying the recruiting and HR community, asking about those types of practices. So not only is it an increased use of assessment, but an increased use of simulation-based assessments where, they're recreating elements of the job as an interactive simulation to get a work sample. And the reason that those are being more readily adopted is because they do the data collection. The thing I described earlier about the, using a rating scale in the interview, that adds a degree of administrative demand to the recruiter to actually enter all the values from the interview into a database.
Mm-hmm.
People don't like to add that little extra administrative step. It also requires that they have an analyst who has the skills and capabilities. One of the largest growing occupations, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is the industrial organizational psychologist. Those are the individuals who actually have the skills and the expertise to apply talent analytics to selection, candidate evaluation data, and job performance data. So it's a growing population. More organizations not only are contracting with them as external providers, but more and more organizations are hiring them internally to have that level of internal expertise for talent analytics as they become more sophisticated. So those are a couple of trends. I think Josh Burson, in one of his more recent papers, he presented kind of the talent acquisition maturity cycle. And he talked about that level four as being an integrated systems thinking approach. And some of the things that he means by that is that you actually collect data, conduct analysis, and make decisions on what to do more of and what to do less of using evidence. And that's one of the things that an assessment does, is it allows you to actually collect evidence around performance in a numeric fashion. It's very difficult to analyze words. So anything that's resume-based, such as LinkedIn. So in LinkedIn, the only thing they're doing is looking at words and dates, and so job titles and words that people use to describe their jobs, and you can search engine optimize your resume to show up in different ways, but just the choice. And so it's not really an objective, it's a subjective, it's a spin document. And organizations, whether they're looking at their own internal applicant tracking system and say, show me everybody who's got a 2-year degree and 2 years of experience, or a 4-year degree and 5 years of experience with marketing, it's still a huge population and it doesn't tell you anything about their effectiveness. And, the Candidate Experience Award survey from this year, 40% of the companies reporting said that they're getting over 200-to-1 applicant-to-hire ratio. So the demands of being able to discern and differentiate among candidates with more objective information is one of the growing performance challenges that talent acquisition faces. Is we've made it so easy to apply,
mm-hmm.
but we've made it easy to apply with useless information. The resume has fundamentally been unchanged since the Middle Ages, and it's still a word-based document that almost nobody writes by themselves, so it's a collaboratively developed spin document, and it's the exercise where the candidate hopes to show up on your word search, and you hope to find something valuable that's in there. Where an assessment is a surgical extraction of information, where I've intentionally designed to go out and get specific information that I need and that I can use for analysis to do evidence-based staffing process improvement. So those are some big trends that are I think, we will continue to see into the coming year.
Well, Joseph, hearing this, one question that comes to my mind is, what if, you know, the initial process of getting that candidate in front of this recruiter or getting the attention of recruiters, we cannot rely on this spin and win situation, right, with the SEO or through LinkedIn or through ATS and finding that candidate. What if the recruiters are missing the right candidate who is going to perform much more effectively than probably a candidate that they are going to choose through their spin and win situation of choosing through the SEOs. So do you see any kind of a difficulty when it comes to recruiters are losing their candidates who are more suitable than what they have selected?
Well, there's always that question about, in any population, are there better candidates than the one I'm talking about, or did my process turn off somebody who could have been a good candidate? And you can always make an argument to say, yes, you know, that anytime you put a different filter in place, or an experience for the candidate to go through, that candidate may be, that experience may be more or less engaging. And so when our hurdle is paste your resume here, everybody does it. When your hurdle is give me a little bit more information, the totally passive candidate who doesn't even want to invest a few more minutes drops out. Could be a good passive candidate, could be a bad passive candidate. But you identified their threshold of effort to apply for the job. And so how interested were they really in your job experience? We were just visiting some of our clients this week, and they presented us with drop-off rates of every step of their applicant, you know, process. And they had candidates who dropped off at the background information, candidates who dropped off at the e-verification at the end. You know, filled out everything and got to the e-verification. There's something about it says, I'm not going to click submit. They had, you know, candidates who backed off at the, or dropped off at the post your resume here. So what kind of effort does it take? And so we don't know all the reasons why candidates drop out. And so you can spend time chasing all the drop-offs and say, you know, what caused you to leave? Where you can say, here's the people who made it through my process. So the questions become, what have you done to make your process engaging so that it actually has value and meaning to the candidate? What have you done to make your process educational so that it's not just a one-way information suck? You know, in many application processes, the company experience says, gimme, 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 gimme to the candidate asking for everything. But when you create really robust candidate experience, they learn as much or more than you ask for. So it's a balanced two-way approach to the candidate experience. And that contributes to what we call a brand positive experience. And so when you apply for a job at your company, one of the things to consider is to say, is every step of this process adding or detracting to how a candidate might think about our company and our brand? So when we look at the experience economy and what's happening to the candidate experience, you can create a more brand positive or a less brand positive or a brand unfavorable experience. And so the more favorable the experience, the more engaged, the more time in, the more willing the candidate is to go through that process. And then, you know, the third element is, how evaluative is it? And if you're still just relying on words, it's not truly an evaluative. It's only comparative to say, you use these words and you used different words. And as an example, we were doing a project years ago, and the client had said, I want to give value to demonstrated track record of on-the-job learning. And this is back right at the beginning of more robust online applications. And I was literally looking at resumes, and I came across two resumes. Two guys worked at the same manufacturing plant, started at the same year, had the same job title, described their work experiences exactly the same, One of them puts on their resume two quality control and continuous improvement workshops that he had attended, and the other guy didn't. Now, this was a manufacturing company in a small town in the Midwest, and I just had to sit and ask myself, what's the likelihood that these two gentlemen who started at the same time, had the same job titles, listed the same skills and experiences, that one of them went to the workshop and the other one didn't? I'm thinking they probably both went to that same workshop that was conducted on quality, et cetera. When we look at their resumes, one of them gets treated more effectively. But if we ask a question in the applicant tracking system or in a work experience questionnaire, it says, tell me how many hours of continuous improvement and quality control training you've had. Now I surgically extract that from both of them. I treat them both fairly, and I get what I'm looking for from all the candidates. I find out by asking them directly, not hoping they put what I was looking for in their resume, by asking them that as a very specific request that I'm looking for. Those are the things when we become more strategic in how we get the information we want rather than hopefully go searching for it in a resume.
Correct. Well, Joseph, we have about 3 minutes left at this point, and I really wanted to go back to one of your points, that is job simulation. So when do you think job simulation works, and when do you think job simulation fails?
Well, the more relevant the simulation is to the job, the more likelihood it will work. But what makes simulation work is what's called local validation. You want to do an appropriate study. So one is establishing job relevance, but the second one would to have a large population of incumbents go through the simulation and collect all their performance metrics on I talked about this in my last time, the three O's of quality hire: the supervisor's opinion, observed behaviors through a behaviorally anchored rating scale, and then objective metrics of performance. And then you can do a talent analytics measure to say, how does response to the simulation correlate to performance metrics? And that's how you build a scoring algorithm. And then the second way you make it work is to actually repeat that experiment every time you've hired a statistically appropriate size group of people, and you can rerun the analysis so it gets smarter over time. When does it fail? It fails when the simulation is too far removed from the job. It's too abstract, and the candidate looks at it and goes, why am I doing this? And that's one of the challenges right now in some of the abstract gaming, is there are organizations presenting games that are truly games, not work samples. And so there's a hopeful search to say, does response to this game have something to do with job performance? And you may find something. And so, and the other one is where you implement a simulation, an off-the-shelf simulation, without doing the in-house analysis to say, how does response to the simulation correlate to performance on the job? So it really goes back to using the services of an industrial organizational psychologist to conduct great talent analytics called validation analysis to say, can we establish and document the relationship between response pattern to the simulation and on-the-job performance? And then you've got an evidence-based selection system.
Well, Joseph, thank you so much for being here with us today and sharing more about quality of hire and job performance prediction, and in fact, really interesting time to proficiency. So where can our audience connect with you and find out more details about what you do?
Well, you can find us on the web at ShakerCG.com. I tweet at Virtual Joe, and you can reach out and connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm Joseph P. Murphy on LinkedIn. Happy to connect. And if you would like a white paper on is your assessment working, you can go to our website, fill out the contact form, and just write white paper in the contact form, and we'll send you our newest white paper on is your assessment working.
Well, thanks, Joseph, for this insightful conversation, and we look forward to having you again on the show. Have a wonderful rest of the day.
Nisha, thank you very much, and thanks, everybody, for listening. Look forward to continuing the dialogue.
Thanks, Joseph. Bye-bye.
Bye now.